Hey, everybody, welcome to This Life Podcast with me, Dr. Drew. Hey, everybody, welcome to a very special end of the year podcast and simulcast and stream. This life, hashtag you live, courtesy of Social CBD. I'll tell you more about that after the break. Happy holidays to everyone. This is the very special holiday season where depression is what everyone's always asking me about. So we're going to talk about the many faces of depression and some of the more novel ideas for treatment. You can call me for questions, 984-2-DR-DREW. That's 984-237-3739. And we got lots of great calls coming in already and two terrific guests. Also, I want to say that we will have an Ask Dr. Drew podcast, very similar to this, right after this live show at about an hour and a half from now. We're taking caller questions other than depression at that point as well. That'll be at 4:30 Pacific Standard Time. Give us a call back again, 984-2-DR-DREW. And we have been working very hard in expanding this technology that you're able to watch and I'm able to talk to you from, which is extraordinary. It makes it easy to notify you when the show starts. So go to drdrew.tv, find the email list and text sign up, and as well as the live video. We are on facebook.com/drdrew, youtube.com/drdrew. Also for the Twitter fans, live on periscope.com. Follow us to get it live. If you go to sign up at drdrew.tv, we'll send you a blast when we go live with these things. And again, the number, same number there, 984-237-3739. On another note, those of you that know me from my daytime KBC radio program, that show will end in the new year, and it has been a great experience. I've been there for almost, I think, 7 years now. No regrets. I will miss Leanne Tweeden and Mike Catherwood and Lawrence Vaughn, all of whom are my co-hosts during the run of that show, and they did a great job, but I know you will see them again in shows like this, no doubt. You saw Catherwood just recently as well. And don't be discouraged. You can get listen to the podcast from Midday Live at drdrew.com. And also a reminder, I will continue to be doing Dr. Drew After Dark, courtesy of Your Mom's House, which is doing well as the Adam and Dr. Drew show. So I continue to, what word shall I use? Participate with Adam on a daily basis. He and I are there 5 days a week at the Dr. Drew and Adam show. So do check that out, 5 days a week. So at this point, let me, having dispensed with all that, let me get to my guest, Ben Spielberg. Ben is from the TMS and Brain Health in Santa Monica. Is that the actual name of the place?
TMS and Brain Health,
Brain,
yes.
Brain Health. Ben is a neuroscience and education master degree program from Columbia University. He focused on neuromodulation, which I think anybody knows me, know I'm obsessed with brain stuff. And not just neuromodulation, but more particularly the non-pharmacological treatment of brain disorders. Would that be about right?
Exactly.
And we'll talk about some of that stuff. We're also going to have Dr. Gary Donovitz in here a little bit later from BioT Medical. I've spoken to him before. I want to, you know, this is a courtesy of our producer, Susan Pinsky, who herself was misdiagnosed as depression, went on the pellets, which is what Dr. Donovitz represents, and had a complete remission of her depressive symptoms. It was misdiagnosed. It was perimenopause, menopause, mm-hmm. which can have mood and anxiety associated with it. That's a symptom. That's not the diagnosis. The diagnosis is menopause, perimenopause. Everyone missed that. She went on the pellets. Everything got better. Mm-hmm. So now she's an enthusiast. So we'll bring Dr. Donovitz back. We thought it was important to talk about it because there had been some press on the pellets recently. Controversy. Is it good?
Right.
Is it bad? So we'll get to that a little bit later in the show. Also, we're going to talk to a patient, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
so
we are.
We got a lot to get to. So first, talk about, let's just do in general, you grew up in Los Angeles.
Sorry?
You grew up in Los Angeles.
I did.
And how did you get into neuroscience?
I got into neuroscience because when I was about 22 years old, I got a job doing neurofeedback as a technician in a drug and alcohol treatment
center. This is the click, click, clicks on the right?
So click, click, click. So what we would do is we would actually put EEG electrodes on people's heads, and we would connect those electrodes to a computer. And we tell the computer that when a person is exercising good brain activity to reward them in some way. So the screen would get larger if they were doing something good with their brain, whereas if they were doing something bad, let's say, and these are
right.
just brain waves, so we're sort of assigning what's good and what's bad. But if they were doing something bad, then the screen screen would get smaller or the volume would decrease. And over time, they would actually learn how to volitionally control their own brain waves, which would coincide with their symptoms getting better.
Right. Now people get, I did a couple of television programs on this topic where they were using actually fMRI up in Stanford for a while.
Right.
And people, I couldn't get the producers to get it right. They're like, oh, I see. So you're teaching them to be zen and calm. It's like, no, we're not doing anything like that.
Yeah.
You're teaching them to get access to parts of their brain that are non-conscious, not at this point under volitional control, and through a very complicated technology, give them the feedback mechanism whereby they suddenly gain some mastery over that.
Right.
Would that be about the way to say it?
Exactly. Yeah. And with fMRI, it's so interesting because what they'll do is they'll have people literally just look at a picture of their own brain and say, okay, you see this part, let's change the color in it. Let's literally, you know, increase the blood flow to this area.
And everyone, my experience with these patients, and I don't have a lot, was they, each one of them has their own sort of mechanism for activating this stuff. The study I'm talking about at Stanford was looking at a fireplace getting brighter and lower, similar to what you're doing. And each patient would have a different, they wouldn't say, I'm going to make the fireplace. They'd think, oh, I have little elves who are digging coal. They'd have very strange ways of accessing it from a standpoint of the image they would use to get to the brain functions. It's not a direct process, right?
It's not. And that was always the hardest part about when people first came in and they would say, how do I make this move? How do I increase the volume? And you say, you know, it's kind of just this this relaxed focus that you have to have, and you have to let your body figure it out.
You figure it out.
Exactly.
Yeah. Everyone figures out differently. All right. So there you were. And then what happened?
So I did that. I did that while I was studying psychology at Loyola Marymount University. And once I graduated, I realized that I really wanted more of the hardcore neurobiology. And so then I got accepted to the neuroscience and education program at Columbia, where I kept doing the EEG research and I learned more about TMS. So while I was there, I got a job at a TMS center, and I was actually originally hired to do neuroimaging before and after TMS.
Neuroimaging meaning fMRI imaging?
Or? Not fMRI. We were using EEG. We were actually using qEEG. So it's an
quantitative
EEG. A quantitative EEG.
So you create images out of that.
You create images out of it, mapping. And it basically gives you these statistics once you record all of these electrode sites, and then it tells you where each person lies in the general population. So you may get a number that says this person has more of this type of brain wave in this particular spot than 97% of the population, or less than 97%, or something like that.
It's still very primitive interpretive biology.
It's
not a giant leap from phrenology. I don't mean to be cruel, but I've seen some great derivative conclusions from quantitative EEG, but it feels like, whoa, we should be able to have something.
We should have more. And the issue with it is that you end up, if you do it right, you end up with so many different variables that it really takes so much energy to figure out what is actually going on here.
Yes.
So in the clinic that I have now in Santa Monica, we actually don't even use it, because what I ended up realizing is I can figure out what to do with TMS just by, you know, talking to someone for 5 minutes.
Just their clinical response.
Exactly.
Their clinical symptoms.
Exactly.
So talk to me about what TMS is and how it works.
So TMS stands for transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is a mouthful. And it's basically a device that can actually create a magnetic field, which basically turns on those brain cells.
So a reminder that when you have a magnetic field, currents run through magnetic field. So if you, I'm assuming it's around the brain.
Yeah, so we put a device on top of their head.
Yeah, and then it focuses the field, and so the current is the current, which is electrobiological, you know, shifts across cell membranes that transmit that electricity.
Exactly. So neurons they're either on or off, and there's been a lot of research with depression since the mid-90s that have shown that, you know, if you look at the brain of someone with depression and compare that brain or compare a brain of someone without depression, you're going to see the same pattern over and over again. You're going to see underactivity in a specific part of the brain called the left dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. tracks. And so what TMS does is when it creates that magnetic field, we see increased activity in the left dorsolateral.
What's the thinking about what that region does? And it's not doing in depression.
So it's complicated. You know, that region alone, we know it's associated with working memory, with executive function, with a lot of the things that really make us human.
All right. So prefrontal cortex is the part in the front of your brain here. This is the part that develops in adulthood. Sorry for all the adolescents out there. We're our prefrontal cortex is what you have to use because that part is kind of shut down, particularly in the males. And it's broken into different pieces, and there's even some controversy on the anatomy. There's the ventral medial prefrontal cortex, right. The dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. I believe the insula is right in there against all that, right?
Insula, orbital frontal.
And the orbital frontal, which maybe ties it all together. Maybe. Yeah. Maybe. Do you believe that?
I do. Yeah.
I believe that too. Okay, good. But the ventral dorsal medial prefrontal cortex on the left is what we're talking about.
Dorsolateral prefrontal cortex on the left,
which is sort of here, sort of. Mm-hmm. And it is doing what? It's raising. The chemistry there is doing.
So
I can't imagine what that would be.
So the lay explanation really is that there's this underactivity in this area. We know it's associated with depression, and we see that as people get better with something like TMS, we see increased gray matter in that area. We see increased neuroplasticity. The real explanation is that there's really this complicated pathway involved. So you have the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is connected to, which is underactive, and there's a very direct connection to a part of the brain called the subgenual anterior cingulate cortex.
Subgenual anterior, so almost thalamic cortex.
Very close, yeah, very so, close.
And so there's, in my experience, thalamus always gets into the conversation about mood, but no one knew why.
Yes.
So maybe we were just thalamus adjacent all this time.
It's very possible, and it's funny because this particular part of the brain, we really have no idea what it does,
right,
other than every single study that looks at sadness in fMRI machines always has this particular area being overactive.
Overactive. And underactive in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex.
Exactly.
And I'm guessing that it's also overactive in 20 other things.
Right. Yeah.
Where else? Just if you know.
But what's interesting is it's primarily sadness with this area. So we know that this area is associated with an increased sense of sadness, but we haven't actually found any other associations with it. We found
just sadness.
Just sadness. Yeah.
You found what?
We found that this area or that sadness has associations with some other areas as well, like increased activity in the amygdala.
Right. So my understanding of the amygdala, again, although it's always going through incarnations, I just think of it as a salience center. Mm-hmm. It's just acknowledging that's important.
Right.
And so if you're sad, a lot of stuff seems important to your brain. That maybe even isn't important.
Right.
Right. It's one of the problems with depression. You start obsessing about things and thinking about things and ruminating about your depression. That seems important.
Right.
Right. Right. So it makes sense to me. Is that lateralized at all too?
I don't know.
That's interesting.
I'm not sure if that's lateralized. It probably is to an extent.
And why do we, and is it always on the left side in even left-handed people?
So
or does it switch?
It switches in about 10% of left-handed people.
Oh, well, that's about how many left-handed people are truly left-handed, right?
Yes.
So your call screener, my producer, is truly left-handed. You can tell if somebody's truly left-handed by how they write. You know how we write like this? Left-handed people write like this. Right-handed people who write with their left hand write like this.
Mm.
And they write sort of backwards.
I did not know that.
A little neuroscience. Clinical neuroscience. But you watch her do it. She's like, my wife just does it this way. Like, there's always her... But she's a lot of left-handed people are also sort of quasi-ambidextrous too, right? So it doesn't fully shift in the lateralization.
Right.
And so TMS, so you're creating a current in that part of the brain, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex.
Mm-hmm.
which I'm probably boosts up the sadness center too, right? Or decreases the activity of the sadness center.
Right. So one other major function of the prefrontal cortex in general is that it's responsible for inhibiting all of these deeper brain structures, so that these primal areas are not going overactive at times when it would be inappropriate to.
Right.
Right. So that we know how to behave in a society.
Right. 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 We were talking about norepinephrine and serotonin. Mm-hmm. And how these various chemicals, particularly in that region, are part of the story.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we know that antidepressants that involve serotonin, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and norepinephrine, and things like that, work very well for some people. And I'm sure that as a physician dealing in mental health, you've seen that,
sure,
right?
Sure.
You've probably seen some people improve after a few weeks with low dose SSRIs, mm-hmm, in a very dramatic way. But the research shows that 30% of people just do not respond to traditional antidepressants,
yep,
and talk therapy.
Right.
So it's clear that there's really something else going on here that doesn't just involve the traditional neurotransmitters.
And to be fair, we know a lot about what the antidepressants are doing. We really don't know how they work.
We don't.
We really just don't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so that makes sense that we'd have some mystery around the non-responders.
Exactly.
Because we don't know what the responders are doing either. Mm-hmm. So non-responders, 30%. And when you say in clinical practice, most of those people are non-responders. Those are the people that are slogged through multiple medication.
Right.
They're adding the Abilify's and all the other stuff to see if there's something, their mood stabilizes,
right,
see if there's something more going on here than, mm-hmm, just a depression. I mean, that's, mm-hmm, sort of the way psychiatrists are taught.
Yeah.
Now, in your recommendation, you would try TMS at that point, right?
Of course,
yeah.
Yes. And actually, in other countries like Japan, for instance, TMS is actually recommended as a first-line treatment. So before anyone even tries medication, they would go to this temporary treatment that can have real long-term benefits.
Now, this shouldn't be confused with electric shock therapy, which is a general activation of the brain. It's trying to do the same thing, but it does it by causing a seizure.
Exactly. So electroshock or ECT really induces, it creates this large electrical field that induces a seizure in the brain, and it does this multiple times. It involves anesthesia. There is sometimes temporary or even permanent memory loss. There's confusion. There's cognitive fog. There's really a lot of pretty serious side effects involved with it.
Right.
Whereas TMS, instead of this really large electrical field, it's really just a focused magnetic field without any of those side effects.
Right. I'm a fan. It's expensive, isn't it? It's a little expensive.
It's actually covered by insurance. So,
really?
So depending on the insurance company.
You have to have failed other things, though, first, right?
Most insurance companies, yeah, require that you failed anywhere between 1 and 4 antidepressants in the past.
4. That seems so silly.
It does.
And then probably you have to go to high doses and stuff. And
exactly. Augmentation trials, things, yeah, like that.
Let us take a ketamine call, because this is also an interesting area of research that you, mm-hmm, know something about. And the caller's name is Dylan. Hey, Dylan.
Hi. Yes, I'm 34 years old. I have treatment-resistant depression. I'm just wondering about ketamine being approved by the FDA. So it's covered by insurance, because right now the only places that do it are out-of-pocket cash. Which is not doable for me because I'm on Social Security.
Hold on a little bit. The
disability.
S-ketamine is available.
Right.
There's a nasal spray that's available. Now, my question is that only after... Hold on a second. Is that only after the infusion therapy that's efficacious, or can you use it as an individual therapy?
So S-ketamine or Spravato, that's the brand name, which is essentially half of ketamine, was FDA approved in early 2018. People use it instead of the infusions. So
I have some people using it after the infusions as sort of a maintenance thing. I don't know if that's just some centers are doing that. Probably
that may happen, yeah, but that's not the indication,
yeah,
for,
yeah,
it. The indication is, after someone has tried a few different medications, they can do the S-ketamine nasal spray. And they'll come in, I think it's twice a week for about a month, and then they figure out some sort of maintenance schedule. And because it's FDA approved, it's possible to get a single case agreement with insurance to cover it.
Have you tried that, Dylan?
No, right now I'm not seeing any doctors. Right, I've given up on treatment. I'm trying to get. I want to. I mean, it's complicated. I'm have very limited insurance right now. So yeah.
Is there? Dylan, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I wouldn't feel comfortable as a primary care physician prescribing that.
Right.
And yet I often get in these desperate situations with people that don't have insurance. They've tried everything. And I feel like I would like to. Is there any intermediate way to get this medication without having to come in and see a psychiatrist and all that kind of stuff?
Not really. So the only way to get esketamine or ketamine infusion therapy is to either go to a dedicated clinic that focuses on this. So, for instance, TMS and Brain Health, we are going to start offering esketamine. We have ketamine infusions that we do. But other than that, it's really up to the individual's provider.
So I've seen some striking responses from ketamine. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you have too.
Yeah.
Right? People that are just resistant as hell, all of a sudden, three treatments, and they're like markedly better. Mm-hmm. What's the mechanism they suspect there? Any ideas?
So we don't know that much. We know something. So we know that, for instance, stress is a very big factor in depression, and we know that
whatever that means.
Right, right. So, and when we say stress, that can mean, it can mean developmental trauma. It can mean literally the current life stressors, like work stress, family stress, things like that.
Loss,
grief anxiety. Is a very, yeah.
So it's all kinds of things. That's why people say stress, everything. Like, what are we talking about? I'm going to bet, I don't know much about the mechanism, but ketamine is a dissociative anesthetic. Mm-hmm. So it literally disconnects you from, more effectively than an opiate, say, from horrible things.
Right.
And I'm wondering if that's somehow helping people regulate their emotions.
Well, I think that's part of it. And what we tend to see is that, very, very low dose ketamine, like so low that you can't even feel it, it doesn't do anything and there's no therapeutic effect there.
Right.
You have to somehow push into that disassociative state,
right,
even a very mild disassociative state, and then the therapeutic effect
will start
kicking in.
That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. And I'm worried about it in drug addicts. I've seen some relapses in people that were doing awfully well. And and if I know real, honest to God, drug addiction, if you give anything that is activating that reward setup, watch out.
and that's, watch out. That's the issue, because with addiction, obviously, if you peel away the substance abuse, there's almost always a mental health issue there. And so if it's really this depression that's causing the addiction, you have to ultimately make that decision.
How does it, do you guys do anything with panic attacks?
Not specifically, no.
So panic is not something that TMS helps with. I'm surprised.
We have people who will come in and they have
depression. Because depression and panic go together a lot, yeah.
They do. So people will come in with depression and anxiety and panic and OCD and PT. When we see people with these complicated things, then they tend to be better candidates than someone who's, they just have panic attacks, right? That's really their only symptom.
Yeah. Although, gosh, when people get better from panic attacks, they'll usually look back and go, I think I was depressed.
Right.
So that's me. That was my story. I had panic attacks in college, and I was aware I wasn't happy. When I look back now, I'm like, oh, I was profoundly depressed.
Profoundly. Yeah.
Let's see. I'm trying to get some calls here that are pertinent to. Why don't we bring in your case, your patient?
Okay.
This is your patient, Elizabeth?
Yeah. So she was a patient at our center. Yes.
Okay. And maybe we should go to break. We'll go to a break and we'll bring Elizabeth in, and then we'll bring Dr. Donovitz in later to talk about hormone therapy and its effect on mood.
Great.
Be right back. The CBD industry is still pretty much the Wild West when it comes to claims and criticisms. The science is catching up with the industry. We will have clinical science soon enough, and there seems to be an overwhelmingly positive response these days to CBD's efficacy. We've all heard the reports, and luckily, our good friends at Social CBD are raising the industry testing standards. They like to say they are test-obsessed. Social CBD works closely with their suppliers and multiple third-party labs to ensure you are getting exactly the package that they say you are getting. High-quality CBD with 0.0 THC. And Social CBD wants you to be skeptical. That's why they put a QR and batch code on every package. This allows you to check all the test results for your product, not general testing, the product, the specific batch you bought. And while Social CBD broad spectrum products are available in a range of formulations, each of which is clearly described so you can make an informed decision without all that hype and promises that sound too good to be true. To learn more, go to drdrew.com/socialCBD. That is my website, drdrew.com/SOCIALCBD. For a limited time, you can save 20% at checkout with the code DrDrew. Now let's get back to the show. I want to welcome Elizabeth to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. So how did you get to the point where you started contemplating TMS?
Well, I was one of those cases that you were talking about, a multiple failure on several different antidepressants.
How long had you been working trying to get some sort of response?
Oh, for decades.
Decades?
Yes.
Yeah, and I'm imagining, because I've seen lots of cases like that, I'm going to imagine you had periods where like it's kind of working and then it would stop, that kind of thing.
Yes. Yes.
Ugh, how frustrating.
Yes. And in my most, before I started TMS, I was on a couple of different, and drugs are always added to the equation. And I was getting better, but I was still depressed. So I had made some progress, but it was very frustrating because I couldn't get
right
all the way there. Because I do know what my undepressed brain feels like.
Right. And Ben, I don't know if we can get Ben on camera or not, but I'm going to have him sort of, he's sitting by here. And so this idea of complete remission is something that is becoming more, I don't know, more anticipated, let's say. I mean, mm-hmm. I remember back in the early days of the SSRIs where they're like, well, they're feeling better. You know, but now people should look forward to a true remission, sustained resolution of symptoms, right?
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And with TMS, we're seeing that about 50% of people are getting to that sustained remission.
50% of the recalcitrant cases.
Yes.
And you were lucky enough to be one of those people.
That's correct.
Did it happen fast or was it after only like weeks of therapy, or how did it work?
It happened fast and then a little bit over the course of the treatment. I was, because of my experiences with not getting success with antidepressant therapy, the meds, I wasn't expecting very much. But in fact, the first day of treatment, I felt something activate in my brain. I was so excited about it.
That's literally what's happening.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Ben showed me a picture of what the brain looks like when it's not receiving blood flow. Mm-hmm. And it you know, I don't know that that's what I was feeling, but I felt like over the course of treatment, I felt like my brain was waking up.
So, spec scans we're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the do you guys do spec scans?
We don't.
Okay. So that's the blood flow stuff. And you have to have maintenance now?
I don't. Ben knows more about this than I do, but I think it's a very few amount of patients who actually need to come back for maintenance. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, it seems like about 10% of people need to come back for maintenance.
And was it out of pocket? Did your insurance pay for it?
It was out of pocket.
And still worth it, I'm sure, with what you were dealing with.
Definitely.
And probably less expensive than the medication you've been going through.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The medication will put you out of house and home. And I think about it this way. You sink some time and money into the TMS, but if it's effective, think about all of the monthly visits to the psychiatrist and the drugs and the trips to the pharmacy. It's a phenomenal time and money savings.
And let me ask this. Sometimes, very not uncommonly, people get sort of, lots of side effects of the medication, right? And even manic episodes. Did you ever have anything like that?
I did.
So that's interesting to me. And the reason I ask that, this does not have that potential. Is that true?
It actually does have the potential to cause a manic episode, but you just have to be careful, right? You have to track their symptoms. Nobody's going to go into one manic episode after one session.
Do you put those people on a mood stabilizer and just forge on?
We don't do any of the medication management, but we
would that be the desired course? I mean, you wouldn't stop treatment necessarily, would you? We just use mood stabilizers. Put a ceiling on it and then get something on the depression.
I'm not on a mood stabilizer.
No, I know, but I'm sure that was part of your course.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm just asking what are the ways they kind of help that if something like that happens during TMS, which you didn't have, right?
No.
Is that true?
That's true. No, I did not have an episode during TMS.
Yeah.
So what we would do if someone seems like they're going into a manic episode is we would actually modulate some of the parameters of TMS. So we would either change the time, we would decrease the duration of each session, or we would move the magnet to a different part of the brain and do a more inhibitory, relaxing protocol.
How did you find your way to TMS?
My psychiatrist referred me after many, many months of the medication not getting me to be where I wanted to be mentally, emotionally, psychologically.
And what did you think when you first heard about this?
I was scared.
Yeah, like, what's this? Magnets in my brain?
Yes. He said, see if your insurance covers TMS. I said, what is that? He said, transcranial magnetic stimulation. And I thought, I just had these pictures of ECT for movies in my head.
Everybody, please disavow yourself of all the movies you've seen about psychiatric hospitals. It does not apply to today. That is from 50 years ago, talking about things that happened 100 years ago. So, although not that there were not egregious excesses by the psychiatric. Sometimes I think, you know, when people get very critical about psychiatry, that period when they were doing crazy stuff, I'm like, they got a point. But right. that is long ago, long ago. And did you think about ketamine? Was that something that was presented to you also?
He did. My psychiatrist did talk to me about ketamine, but he suggested TMS. TMS was the first thing that came
out of his
mouth. Isn't that
interesting? Why would he have done that, you think?
I think TMS is more of a long-term solution, whereas ketamine, it works very well for some people very quickly, but it's just not a long-term solution. You have to figure out some sort of maintenance schedule.
So for somebody who has recalcitrant depression, you're needing a longer-term solution than ketamine would probably. But still, those are the guys that get the ketamine, the recalcitrant guys.
I think people are more drawn towards ketamine. I think it's a little trendy right now. And I think that there's this idea that if something can work really fast, maybe I'll just try that first. And the schedule of TMS can be an issue for some people. So people have to come in 5 days a week for about 6 weeks. And then there's also a 6-session taper over the following 3 weeks.
How long does that take per session?
So that's really what we specialize in, is we do a 3-minute TMS protocol. Okay, so TMS used to take 37 and a half minutes per treatment, and the FDA cleared a 3-minute protocol last year, which basically uses a different frequency of the magnet pulsing to better enable the brain to learn.
Got it. And if somebody wanted to look into this at your center, where do they go?
TMSbrainhealth.com.
TMSbrainhealth.com. We now... Caleb, good job. We now have a shot of the two of you, so I feel comfortable now going on to the callers here, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. And we'll keep Elizabeth here with us. She may have something to add, which is having a patient perspective I love. Devin, you have a question?
Yeah.
Hi, Devin.
It might be a little bit off topic from what you guys may be talking about.
Okay.
It's that, how many people do you think are walking around today with mental discrepancies and are just not, you know, not dealing with it, even not understanding it, not wanting to get help or feel the pressure of society, just, you know, kind of against them.
It's a great question.
I know you,
go ahead. You know what?
I know that you were doing a bunch of work with homeless, you know, with their, you know, mental health and it just not being taken care of.
Right.
And how it's not really being brought to topic. I feel like some of a pressing issue where it can cause,
that,
it goes into other things other than just homelessness.
Oh, yes, sir. You got that right. So it brings up a huge, and you've been in the system a little bit, so maybe you have some perspective on this. So 50% of us will get a diagnosable mental illness during our lifetime. Would that be about right?
I think so, yes.
And what percentage do you think have serious SMI, serious mental illness, which is... I don't know if Elizabeth would necessarily qualify for that, but you know, we're really talking about people that are disabled by mental illness when you say serious mental illness.
Well, I would need you to define that further.
Yeah, I know. And people, let's put in, it's almost impossible to do properly. I'm going to say somewhere in the 10 to 20% range, depending how you define it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know that one of the reasons the National Institute of Mental Health was set up is the Army did a study on military recruits, and they couldn't understand why 30% of their recruits couldn't go into battle, and they found out that 30% had neurologic, cognitive, or psychiatric disturbances that disqualified them from being in the Army, and that they were taking everybody back then.
Right.
So that gives you a sense of the kind of data that's out there. What do you think about the system? Is it responsive to patients' needs?
Oh, I think that this country is horrible in mental health. I think we can all agree on that.
Well, I don't know that we can all agree. I mean, when the three of us can agree on that. And I'm not sure I'm ready to say it's horrible. I'm just saying it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. In so many ways. Mm-hmm. In some ways, it's great, and in some ways, it's obscenely bad. And most of the bad.
Well, I think mental illness is largely misunderstood. I think it I think that those movies that you were talking about that you're supposed to ignore mental hospitals also ignore psych patients as portrayed in those. I mean, there's some truth to it, but mental illness is much more pervasive than a lot of people are willing to admit to.
Oh, yeah.
It's a public health crisis in this country.
Oh, honey, you got that right. I'm all about that.
And that's what I mean when I say that it's, the country is horrible about it, because it's a hard problem to address.
It's hard enough to address if you have all the tools in place to be able to address it. And we have almost none of the tools in place. So then it becomes almost impossible. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of a bigger topic. Let's keep going to the callers, because I got lots of them here. Let's talk to Nicole. She has a question about holidays and mood, that kind of thing. Hey, Nicole.
Hi, Dr. Drew.
Hi,
So my family has experienced a lot of loss within the last few years. My mother died 2 years ago. My biological father died last year. And there's just been my brother and sister-in-law broke up. There's just been a lot of trauma. And I am in a situation right now where my husband and I are possibly contemplating separating. And just kind of trying to keep up with the appearance that we're still together is just causing me damage. I don't know how else to say it, but like, what is the best way to like bring up bad news in a family that's already going through so much?
I'm not sure that there is a recipe for that. You guys are both looking at me leaning back in your chair. One part of me starts to wonder if having something to work on, i.e. your relationship with your husband, might not be an interesting distraction for your family. I don't really know why I'm saying that, but I have this feeling that having something to fix. What did your mother die of?
She got Stevens-Johnson syndrome. And
oh my God.
It just,
from what?
Just, yeah.
From a medication?
The allopurinol. It's a horrible story.
My God.
The doctor,
so let me just tell you what, she's not kidding. Which Stevens-Johnson is the only emergency in dermatology. Certain medication will literally cause your skin to slough off head to toe.
Wow.
And so you become a full body burn patient in a few hours. It's terrible.
That's exactly what happened. And they couldn't diagnose her for a really long time. It actually took me going on the internet and literally looking up symptoms and what new medication she had had. She had gout and they gave her allopurinol.
Anything could do it, really. Terrible.
The short story of it was that she got better, and then the doctor told me I didn't know what I was talking about, and she went to a facility, and he gave it to her again.
Oh my God. And she started to get worse again. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
All right, so let's go back to you and your husband. Is there anyone within the family that you could sit with and have a productive conversation about your relationship with your husband?
Productive. Not really. I mean,
if it's only gonna be unproductive and you know, mishigas, don't do it. If there's somebody in there that's willing to listen and really pay attention and collaborate with you and say, hey, should we tell the rest of them? I don't know what's going on, and sort of build your case slowly rather than dumping, you know, to everybody at the Christmas dinner. Take it easy. Take it slow and easy.
Right.
Don't pretend, right. But I wouldn't be in a hurry. Your family has been through a lot. And it's gruesome, that disease, and you know, Stevens-Johnson. Thanks, Nicole. Sorry you had to go through all that. That's awful. Okay, I'm trying to get more questions for you guys. Hey, let's do this. Why don't we? Why don't you guys switch places? And headsets, and I'm going to bring in Dr. Gary Donovitz. Can we do that, Caleb? Because it's another variation on the theme here. Gary Donovitz is the biotmedical.com is where you can find his materials. He's been here before. He's interested in hormone replacement therapy and particularly bioidentical pellets. We had previously discussed how hormones can be used to treat menopausal symptoms in women. Go ahead and switch spots. And we are, you know, a recent study focused on veterans with opioid addiction, PTSD, and depression. So I thought it might be interesting to bring Dr. Donovitz in here to talk about his experience with hormone replacement therapies of various type, actually. There you are. Look at you. Hi, Gary. Oh, I don't hear him. He hears us, obviously. One
yes,
second.
I can hear you.
There you are. Now you're with us. So we've been doing a whole. You're over Ben right now. There we go. Why don't you sit between us? There you go. I know he's huge. Hold on. There. Yeah. He's got a place at the table now. There we go. So, Gary, talk a little bit about your experience both with women and men as it pertains to hormone replacement therapies and mood.
Well, you actually mentioned the PTSD, which was very early in our studies at BioT, because we really wanted to see what happened with the troops that were coming home from the Middle East. And what we found was both men and women who had hormone imbalances had the worst PTSD. They were already being treated with narcotics. They were already being treated with antidepressants. Mm-hmm. And basically, they were disabled and couldn't even work. Their home lives were in a terrible state. We looked at their hormones, both testosterone and thyroid, and then testosterone, thyroid, and estrogen in the women. And it's interesting in women, the women who actually went to war, who had the lowest estradiol levels, had PTSD. So it's not just testosterone, but it's testosterone, thyroid, and in women also estrogen. And we found once we optimized their hormones, we were able to get them off of their narcotics. We were able to get them off of their antidepressants. And in fact, with what we do, not just with PTSD, but the population in general, we're able to get about 50% of people off their antidepressants. So we feel that hormone optimization is a very important part of treating depression and doing it on the long term.
Yeah, and I've shared the story already today, Dr. Donovitz, that my wife was, you know, diagnosed as a mood disturbance, and it turned out to be perimenopausal menopause that when was corrected, all the mood symptoms, anxiety symptoms completely remitted, completely.
Right. So what happens is women start losing testosterone at age 25, men in their 30s, unless they're exposed to war and some other stress. But for, in general, women in their mid-20s are losing testosterone and they get put on antidepressants, which is really just a Band-Aid, because it's not that they're serotonin deficient necessarily. It's that their hormones are not optimal. Once we optimize their hormones, we can actually avoid that. And long-term use of antidepressants, if you're particularly interested in osteoporosis and other things as I am, is not very good. And they're motivated to come off of these drugs that actually ruin their quality of life versus improve their quality
sometimes.
Of life, which is what we hope to do. Yes.
So, Ben, well, I'm sure what he means, like sexual side effects, libido mm-hmm. problems, that kind of mm-hmm. stuff. But it makes I suspect it makes sense to you that other biological processes affect the brain. That's all we're really saying.
Of course.
Right.
Of course.
Do you have anything in mind? Do you do any kind of workup when you see those regions aren't or hyper and hypoactive that we were talking about earlier?
Right. So we do an initial evaluation whenever someone new calls in and wants to come see us to make sure that they're appropriate for TMS. Because if someone just started feeling depressed recently, there may be some other factors involved, right? Whereas if someone has been depressed since they were a kid or since they hit puberty, which is pretty common, then it's a different story. And it probably is this, you know, more treatment resistant prefrontal cortex etiology. But what we're seeing is, you know,
primary brain as opposed to something else.
Right, right. And all roads lead to Rome in some respect, so that, you know, there's so many different causes for depression now. And there's really this complicated pathway that involves these brain regions, which connect to the hypothalamus. So then you have, you know, this HPA axis and hormones involved.
Yeah, I can't tell you how frequently when I was doing medical evaluations of psychiatric patients, I would find a major medical issue. People would come in with major depression, and what I would find was cancer, heart disease, something mm-hmm. that was new going on that was precipitating the depression.
Right.
That's why in my world, I just always tell people, get a complete, if you're having new psychiatric symptoms, get a complete medical evaluation. Or in older folks, cerebral vascular disease, other
right.
all kinds of, mm-hmm. I've even seen tumors and things show up as depression or other psychiatric symptoms, to be
right.
fair. And Dr. Donovitz, how about the controversy recently? There was a lot of sort of press about pellets and bioidentical hormones. What did you make of all that?
Well, there's been a lot of press. It's a couple of things that are out there that are very interesting, and I think also are going to affect another, and just like WI did, which is what we talked about last time. There's an attack really on bioidentical hormones, mostly by big pharmaceutical companies. We had an international consensus group of doctors who use testosterone in women published in a peer-reviewed journal, and that came out. But there was another consensus group that also got published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology a couple months ago, and these people don't even use testosterone and basically said it should only be used in women who have hypoactive sexual dysphoric disorder, which is a little bit weird. Because with testosterone, we can completely prevent osteoporosis. With testosterone, we can actually reduce breast cancer. With testosterone, we can reduce cardiovascular disease, and we can reduce Alzheimer's. I would think that people, particularly women, would be interested in those long-term diseases, as well as the short-term benefits of fatigue and sleep and weight loss and improved brain function and improved moods and reduced depression. So to have a group take away the medication or the hormone that is actually beneficial to them is going to be the same thing we saw in 2002, where there was an attack on hormones.
That's exactly what I was thinking about. It's so familiar, right? We both went through that. We're talking about the Women's Health Initiative, which was this gigantic study. There was the assumptions and the population they were studying were all flawed. Studies concluded a bunch of things that made us all have to take people off hormone replacement therapies. Mm-hmm. We were told we were witch doctors if we didn't comply with this landmark study. It didn't fit any of our clinical experiences. We were all wondering, what, something's wrong, something didn't seem right. Well, the study was deeply flawed, and we've had to go completely in a different direction. Dr. Donovitz, maybe you want to address that.
Yeah, so the problem was after that, 80% of women came off their hormones, or their practitioners quit prescribing it. Either way, tens of thousands of people died because they didn't get their hormones. And we did lose a whole generation of women. I don't really want to do that again, because the number one killer for women is cardiovascular disease, and both testosterone and estrogen, particularly estrogen early on, but then testosterone later. It's actually protective to the heart. And you guys are talking about depression and mood today. Women who are depressed aren't near as happy, obviously, as they would be if we could get rid of the depression. They don't function as well at home or in the workplace. And now we have a way, and I've just finished a study, 10-year study, 8,000 women with a 70% reduction in breast cancer. We can't afford to lose this generation of women by a group of people whose only interest is big pharma and the money that they support them with. And that's really the bottom line, Dr. Drew.
Well, it may be, or it may just be fear, and I get it. You know, people that are, I academic medicine is very conservative, and to come up with a novel idea, novel approach, takes decades to mill through academic medicine. And, you know, the reason I'm an enthusiast of what you have to offer is I've seen it over and over again clinically. And it's not for everybody, but I've seen the benefits in people that have been mishandled, misdiagnosed, including my own household. Maybe that biases me a little bit. And I have not seen any evidence of long-term adverse effects. So
it's been around for 80 years. So we do have 80 years of data. It's used in 5 continents. So I feel like it's not a novel new therapy, but a therapy that's having a resurgence. And it makes sense, too, because the receptors in the body have already seen testosterone. They've already seen estradiol. They've already seen natural thyroid hormone. And it makes sense that they would do better with bioidentical hormones than a synthetic product for which they've never seen. And the side effects are going to be greater, just like you saw in WHI. But the side effects of bioidenticals are clearly less.
Well, thanks for dropping in on us. Where can people find you?
Think of biotmedical.com. And you can find out if you're a candidate. We actually have a great questionnaire for both men and women, and we're happy to help anybody.
All right. Thank you much, Dr. Donovitz. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
All right. So that's, you know, when one of the things about everything becoming so, specialized, I guess, that, you know, we have to be careful we don't become a hammer and a nail. We're a hammer, the whole world's a nail. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And it's hard. It's hard to suss these things out. You know, when we have common conditions that present with a myriad of solutions, trying to figure out exactly what the right solution is for a given patient is not an easy thing anymore.
Right, you know, right.
We get the right treatment, right diagnosis, right treatment.
Mm-hmm. And it's so complicated with mood, especially depression, because as you said earlier, depression can be both a disorder and a symptom.
Right.
And you know, figuring out what is an arduous process that can often take many months or even years, right? Yeah.
So anything else you want people to know about? I've got tons of questions here. I think I'm going to have to get to them on the next show, and I apologize, you guys, if I'm keeping you on hold forever. Anything else we should talk about on the topic? Do we cover everything pretty much?
I think we covered everything.
Oh, markers. What about markers and genetic markers and biomarkers and the future of all that? Do you have any opinion about that?
Yeah, I think they're great. Yeah. You know, I think we've really made a lot of strides with genetics over the past 10 years or so.
Most of the application has been in the way medications are metabolized, in
right,
my experience.
Right.
That's where it's been a really clear application. Mm-hmm. But I think we're going to have a lot more applications in the future.
Yeah, yeah. So I know there are a couple of those psychiatric genome testing companies that you can go through, and some of them will actually look for TMS as a biomarker to see if someone would be a responder to TMS or not. The issue is that, you know, with TMS, there's so many different variables, right? There's frequency, there's time, there's, you know, placement on the head, there's number of sessions, all of which you can manipulate and have drastically different effects.
What is the biomarker that's associated with response? Do we know?
I don't know it offhand.
That's weird.
Yeah.
I would think of it more of something, a biomarker against response to other things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that TMS becomes
a biomarker for treatment resistance.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Elizabeth, have we covered everything to your satisfaction?
I had one thing to ask.
Please, go right ahead.
That TMS with Ben completely knocked out my anxiety. I didn't get to brag about my terrible, terrible anxiety earlier, but it was crippling. I'm joking now, but it was not funny.
Yeah, and that's an interesting, the relationship between anxiety and depression is always interested me.
Mm-hmm.
As somebody who had panic attacks when I was depressed.
Yeah.
And then because my panic attacks were so poorly managed, I developed generalized anxiety over time, which became severe, and my mood was still bad, but I didn't know it. Did you know? Could you tell the difference between the anxiety and the mood?
I could.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're two terrible flavors, two distinctly terrible different flavors. Yeah.
And so was in your case, there's sort of two common sort of variants. One is the anxiety makes you depressed. The other is the depression amplifies or creates the anxiety.
I'm sorry. Can you repeat that?
Some people get depressed because of their anxiety. Other people, the anxiety is a symptom of the depression.
I think I'm category B.
That's what it sounded like. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so with Elizabeth, what we did is, you know, we started with, there's one FDA-approved placement on the brain. So there's one part of the brain that we stimulated for, I think, a couple weeks, but we still saw some lingering anxiety and sleep issues, right?
Right.
There was some insomnia there.
Yeah.
So what we did is we actually moved the device to a different part of the brain, and we adjusted those, we treated for those specific symptoms.
You remember what that was?
So we treated the right dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. We used the same frequency, but I think it was just 20 seconds, right? 20 mm-hmm. seconds or a minute, something like that.
Isn't the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex also what tends to respond when you look at the change, let's say, in response to cognitive behavioral therapy?
It is, yes.
Isn't that weird?
Mm-hmm.
That's very weird. Did you have CBT? Is that part of
I've read Feeling Good, the new mood therapy.
Right, right. That's an old standard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird because I know that in schizophrenics they're showing some good. Do you treat schizophrenia with the TMS? Because I know they're showing good results in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex with cognitive behavioral therapy.
We don't treat schizophrenics right now. No. Right. We can treat, you know, the negative symptoms of schizoaffective disorder, something like that. But
right, the mood part.
Right.
So where should people go if they're interested again? Where?
TMSbrainhealth.com.
Okay.
Or they can call at 833-TMS-2-DAY.
Two-DAY. Number 2-DAY?
Number 2-DAY.
TMS. Say it again.
833-TMS-2-DAY.
Got it. I appreciate you both being here. We thank Dr. Donovitz for being here as well. We are going to be back in about a half an hour to another Ask Dr. Drew, and my phone screener will talk to each of you that are on hold to figure out how we're going to do this, because you all have great questions and I want to get to them. We're going to take a little bit of break. Thank you all for participating in this broadcast and podcast. We do appreciate it. Dr. Gary Donovitz of BioT Medical, BioTeMedical.com, and also our friend Ben Spielberg from TMS and Brain Health. And thank you, Elizabeth, for being so honest about your... My hope is You're giving me, inspire me to bring more patients in here, and because the patient stories are what people can relate to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very good. Okay, everybody. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Dr. Drew here, and this is just a reminder that the discussions here are not a substitute for medical care or medical evaluation. This is purely for entertainment and education. We hope you learned something, but see your doctor, get proper medical care.